listening to Rattle and Pedal, divergent thoughts on marketing and growing professional services firms. Your hosts are Jason Malicki and Jeff McKay.
So Jeff, today's guest, you know, I have to say it's actually remarkable. We are almost 200 episodes into this series, and I think that Brian is our first CIO. I don't think we've ever had a CIO on the show. We've had a lot of managing partners in IT services firms. We've had marketers from SaaS companies, but I don't think we've ever had another CIO. Am I right or am I wrong?
I think you're right. And no pressure on you, Brian. Will he be the first? Will he be the last?
Exactly. He might say, who sent me here? So I think it's actually really fitting because obviously we're still working through this AI series and we're really trying to learn what firms are doing with AI and some of the systems that are out there that can support professional services firms. So Brian, we're delighted to have you on as a guest today. So with us is Brian Wise. He is the CIO of Sixth Sense, the ABM system, and he's here to talk to us a little bit about what you can do with Sixth Sense and talk about a couple of different things that he's done around AI inside of their organization. So, Brian, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks so much, Jason and Jeff. Appreciate being here. And I didn't realize until just this moment I'm the first CIO. So
it's a lot of pressure. I should have told you that before.
You're going to live up to the billing here. Yeah, for sure.
I didn't do you any favors, did I? All right. So let's start at the beginning. Actually, where does this podcast find you? Where are you?
I live in Menlo Park, California. So part of the Bay Area. And I've grown up here my whole life. Went to a couple other places and came back and have always been sort of caught up in the tech world like most Bay Area kids. And it's a great place to be.
Yeah, it absolutely is. You and I were joking. You're one of the rare lifers there, right? Like, there's not that many people that grew up there and are still there. It's usually, you know,
pretty amazing, you know, how many people from around the world come to sort of experience that entrepreneurial world of the Bay Area, and it is special in that sense. I do think sometimes I forget that just growing up here, but seeing all the change in the Bay has been pretty wild, you know, growing up in the 70s in Cupertino and thinking about what has all transpired and just seeing all the buildings and the growth and everything. And, you know, we were talking earlier before the podcast about my grandmother being from Columbus, where you live. And I remember very vividly one time she called my dad and said, "I keep hearing about this place called Silicon Valley. Is that close to where you live?" And just sort of like how it's grown into something more than that. But anyways, yeah, it's a special place for sure.
That's cool. That's really fun.
I'm curious, what was the technology at the time that hooked you that said, I want to be a CIO?
That's a great question. And actually, my dad was an engineer. He was predominantly working he's a electrical engineer. So he's doing, you know, circuit boards and hard drives and things like that. I actually kind of, as a lot of young kids will do, tried to do the opposite of him. So I got into the sales world. And it wasn't until the 90s came around and the dot-com bubble was getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And thinking about, you know, what jobs could I do that were more in line with tech. And the sales jobs that I was getting presented with just weren't good enough. And so in 1995, I think it was, is when I started thinking about maybe I should get into more of a tech profile and role. So that's when I really started. And it just kind of sucked me back in, you know. And anyways, there's a whole story about the dot-com bubble and bust and everything else there. But it was really the 90s that kind of kicked me into gear.
It's not entirely true, but for our younger listeners, I always point to 95 as sort of the birth of the commercial internet, even though it's not really true. Yeah. But that's sort of when I think that, in my mind, the dot-com bubble starts to form, right? And that whole just explosion of activity and interest and, you know, companies going from not knowing what the internet even was to, you know, throwing millions of dollars at it, you know, overnight. So yeah, that's a cool, that's a really cool period of time, I think.
For sure.
Well, day trading, right? You know, there was, even in Columbus, there were people shutting down retail shops and opening up day trading, you know, internet stock trading, retail stores, you know, that was a thing.
Wild, wasn't it, where you had to go to the internet for your your solid pipes and do some things like that, for sure.
Yeah, exactly. Because you know. So. Yeah. All right. So let's get into this. I want to start with the Sixth Sense Revenue AI platform and just talk a little bit about what it is, what it does, how it helps marketers and sales teams, just at a high level. Yeah. I think it's important to give some context to listeners about really what you're doing with AI in general. From a product perspective and how they can use that in their firms. So I want to start there, and then I want to go deeper into things you're doing internally. So let's start at the top.
I love it. You know, when I joined Sixth Sense, it'll be 2 years in May, and even over those last 2 years, how much the brand of Sixth Sense has improved and people know more about what it does. But even back then, when I started interviewing, I kind of knew the space a little bit, but I didn't quite get it until I started investigating a little bit more. And it's really interesting from a CIO perspective, a lot of the MarTech tools tend to be run by the CMO and marketing operations side. And it's sort of an area that just is not touched by CIOs as much. That is changing actually with sort of the last 2 years and the downturn of the economy and things getting tightened up. But in its simplest form, what Sixth Sense does is it changes the old method of creating a revenue pipeline with just sort of like general email blasts to a lot of contacts, and you're kind of hoping and praying that people respond to you. And of course, the world has changed, and you know, we're all inundated with just tons and tons of, you know, data points hitting you all the time. And so I would say the most humans and buyers especially are, they don't want to answer emails anymore. They're not responding to those sort of normal inputs. And that used to be sort of this, I'm creating these marketing qualified leads, you know, MQL, and there's a better way. And so Sixth Sense, it's been almost 11 years now, but ultimately at the end of the day, what they've built is a large AI engine that grabs multiple data points, combines them all together, and provides a much more targeted sort of report on who you should go after. So who is the account that is really in market for your products? So that's when ABM came about, you know, account-based marketing. And the way we do that is we take, we have subscriber data points, right? So we can grab information from visitors that are going to do research. We will ingest information about people that visit your website. We will ingest your third or your first party data from your CRM. And simply put, we just sort of massage all of that together and really meet the potential account or even an account that is already a customer and say, this is the time to engage because they truly are interested. In the past, with this other method, you were just sort of like hoping, like, and you may be reaching out to somebody that's like not in market and not really interested. And the other thing that's also happened is in the past, in the selling motion, you would need to educate your prospects or your accounts. Now, there's so much information out there that most accounts have already done 70% of their research before they even come to you. And so the other thing that's interesting is if you don't engage with them right at the moment, you might miss them because they've already made their decision. And so at the end of the day, we're a large AI engine that provides signals, creates pipelining, and gives signals to the sellers in your organization of like, this is the time, go meet the moment right now. So that's what Sixth Sense does. And when I think, and why I got so excited about Sixth Sense is like, I started thinking about like, of course it's going to be that way. Why would you do it the old way? The old way is super inefficient. You know, you're just sort of praying and you want to use the power of the overall internet and the data that you have available to you, make more sort of concrete decisions and efficiency gains. So that's it at the highest level. That's what we do. We help marketers and sellers create revenue pipeline and meeting the moment to go engage with your account or customer at the right time.
So Brian, we had a guest on a couple of weeks ago, Ian Brody, talking about email marketing. Please tell me that this barrage of cold emails is the last gasp of that marketing approach in our time, and that the direction you just described is the direction that everyone's going to go.
Well, so the medium, the email medium will exist. So that is for sure. And we have products that actually help with, you know, for more specific email campaigns. What I hope is happening, and I believe we will get there as an industry, as a world, is that when you do receive that email, it's because you're actually interested. So if we see these signals that you're doing research on Sixth Sense, as an example, we have a product called Conversational Email, and we see that, and we will send the email out to that specific buying committee. You know, so if we know the account. We don't necessarily know who all the players are. We have a good understanding who we think the buyers would be. And then you would send emails that are very targeted and specific around, like, hey, we noticed you were looking at this particular product. You filled out a form, which is like even better, right? So we know you truly are interested. And so instead of just sort of spam, it becomes like, oh, I actually was interested in that. And it has very tailored information, like, you should go look at this for more information. So I do think that the personalization and the more specific sort of engagement is going to occur. And the older method will dissipate because of what we talked about. You're just not going to read it. You're just inundated. And we all get this, right? You know, I've got 30 emails this morning about, you know, can I have a meeting? Can I do this? Can I do that? And it's like, I don't even have time for that unless I do have time for it because I have some sort of initiative, right?
You know, I think my first exposure to marketing automation as a concept, looking back, was in 2008. I started hearing about inbound marketing and HubSpot and some of the movement on that. And I always felt like that first wave of tech sort of overpromised and underdelivered. It was sort of like, oh, it's going to reinvent the way that people sell and the way people buy, and it's going to be a much smoother, more efficient experience. And I feel like I look back and in those early days, automation, it would give you like a dossier about a prospect, but it really wouldn't tell you what to do or what's meaningful or what's not meaningful. And there was these kind of artificial lead scoring tools. And I feel like that was sort of just a big disappointment for a lot of B2B marketers and sellers. And I feel like this next wave with AI enabling it kind of opens up a whole another layer here. So I'd just like to hear you talk about that, because my hunch is that that's where we're going. We're going to a place of more sophistication where instead of just having a lead score and, you know, a stack of people in a database, now you actually have not only some intel, but you actually maybe even have some suggested actions. You know, I've seen some of that as well. So talk to us just a little bit about, you know, just your thoughts. Do you agree with me or do you think I'm wrong?
Oh, I agree with you 100%. And I think one of the reasons why those early days, it didn't live up to the promises. Just, we didn't have the computational resources. We didn't have the right data sets quite yet. I mean, we had some signals, but computational resources have gone way up. The technical barrier of setting up the right models, I mean, this is what Sixth Sense is about. Instead of you having to go build your own model, hey, use somebody that's already done it and it's a purpose-built solution. So you're 100% correct. I think that... again, this gets back to, you're not going to do it the old way. You're going to do it the new way. And then you're talking about suggestive actions. Like, that's definitely like what you need to do. You need to say, based on this behavior, based on this research, you need to do X. And internally at Sixth Sense, I mean, we live by that in a big way. We call it a 6QA, Sixth Sense Qualified Account. And we have very tight SLAs internally. So when we see those right signals and it's like, you need to take this action as maybe a development rep, you know, you've got 24 hours. If you have not responded to that in 24 hours, you're missing the moment. So not only are you going to get the actions, you're also going to have to really be specific about how quickly you take action, because that moment could really slip. And it could, and the actions in the future would be like, you know, a follow-up phone call, an email, this particular white paper. Here are the five people you need to talk to. Here's the buying committee. Oh, you don't have the contact information for that suggested buying committee? Sixth Sense has that contact information. And so it's going to be very specific and streamline how sellers engage. And the thing that you'll have to do is like, and really focus the sellers, probably more importantly, on what not to engage, right? Mm-hmm. Don't spend time on that other stuff right now, because that's not going to bear any fruit. This is the area you need to spend time. And so that's where the efficiency gains are really going to kick in.
I thought you said a couple of things in there that were really, really interesting. And the two I wanted to pull out was, one was, and if I go back to my analogy of kind of the emergence of marketing automation, like you said, all the data signals were only coming from interactions with your web property, really. And I think that this next layer of what you have with Sixth Sense and systems like it is signals that are much broader than that. You know, they come from other places. So maybe just talk about that for a few minutes, and yeah, then we can shift gears a little bit.
Yeah. I think that what's happening here, of course, is when you take a look at the marketing stack in general, going down that, it's large. There's many, many pieces and tools, right? And so the partnership and the technical partnerships that's really happening is what's allowing to bring a lot of this together. So G2, as an example, right? We have a great relationship with them. And you can, if, depending on the level of the solution that you're purchasing and using, but let's say you're, you know, an enterprise customer, you can get those G2 signals straight into your Sixth Sense instance. And you can see that, you know, I'm selling widgets and there's 50 companies that sell these types of widgets. I can see, you know, what that account is researching. And it's like, oh, I'm in the top three widget researching, right? Let me get ahead of that. And so that's where the big AI engine really kicks in, because now we've got machine learning and a bunch of different data sets. And oh, by the way, I see that same account has reached out to my website and looked at the following pages. And so then you think about even just better improvement. Now that I know that, the next time that person visits our website, maybe you're using another product that sort of personalize the website experience, so that you know, like, oh, this is what they want to look at. So all of this tech is now really working together. I think there's a lot of marketing tech, as you probably know, if you take a look, there's a ton. And so there is some consolidation that's occurring, but what you're going to see over the next 5 years is a lot more consolidation, a lot tighter integrations, a lot better partnerships, and that experience as a seller or a marketer is going to get just even more efficient and more streamlined.
You're listening to Rattle and Pedal, divergent thoughts on growing your professional services firm. Your hosts are Jason Malicki, principal of Rattleback, the marketing agency for professional services firms, and Jeff McKay, former CMO and founder of strategy consultancy Prudent Pedal. If you find this podcast helpful, please help us by telling a friend and rating us on iTunes. Thank you. Now back to Jason and Jeff.
That's awesome. All right. I'm going to suggest, Jeff, that we shift gears a little bit, because I wanted to learn more about Revenue AI and I wanted to learn more about Sixth Sense. But what I really want to spend some more time on is automation domination. This is a phrase that you introduced me to.
Yeah.
That was a program you led at Sixth Sense. And I just want you to tell us more about it, because I think it's really exciting and really interesting. And so I think it's talking about how you're using AI internally. So let's tell us about it, I guess. That's all I can say.
For sure. So I'll even take a step back and just think about, you know, the role of a modern CIO, right? So you've got all this tech that is much easier to deploy. We talk about technical barrier continuing to lower. And so what ends up happening, especially for a company like Sixth Sense, these hyper growth companies, is they start off, and of course they have sales teams, and they've got to create a product and they got to get going. And then a CIO comes in And so what you see is a lot of inefficiency with just this massive tech stack, you know, anywhere from say 200 to 400 pieces of tech that don't really talk to each other and they're all kind of siloed. And I think they all do a fairly good job in their point solution. But to get an entire ecosystem, you need to get this major business processes outline mapped to the tech that you have and start chipping away at inefficiencies in the machine, so to speak. So modern CIOs that are especially, you know, all native in the cloud, this is a problem. And this is sort of what my career has been. And so when I first got here, I'm like, all right, one of our first things that we're going to work on is looking for ways to get more efficient. And that can be through integrations, that can be through AI, that can be just basic process improvement. And so we talked about from a high level, we were using a V2MOM or an OKR, but at a high level, sort of the highest level key result, what can we do to get the company excited about eliminating waste in the environment that makes their jobs better and makes us more scalable and gets ready for, just sort of major business process architecture improvement is what I would call it. So we sat down and said, all right, what's the main KR that's easy for everyone to grab onto? And we talked about, we came up with 67,000 hours. And what we did there is we roughly took every employee and said, what if every employee could save 1 hour a week over a year's period of time? That's how we came up with 67,000 hours. And when we did that last year, I wasn't sure whether we'd be able to achieve it. But the real meta deliverable, honestly, the care was I can save the hours, but the real meta deliverable was making sure that the company as a whole was thinking differently about the processes and the tools and what they were doing every day. And you think about one of the things that we did that was great was we standard deal process, right? So that we didn't have to have every single deal be looked at by legal or every single deal be approved by X or, you know, whatever it is, and get it so that those deals can flow through the system. And if they're very standard, they just go. And so the sales reps have the opportunity to, you know, here's the criteria, let's move it through the system. And all of a sudden, you know, 40% of our new deals no longer get touched because they're all automated or they have the right process in place. So that was really the mindset of it. And what was awesome is the reason we came up, and actually I got to give credit to Michelle Morrison on my team, who actually coined the phrase automation domination. It was really about getting a champions group. So we call them the Autodom champions. And you just grab people within the business that are passionate about eliminating waste. And a lot of that waste is because someone's got to update a spreadsheet every day. Like, why would you do that? Why would you not just automate that?
Yeah.
Another classic, I'm giving you some simple examples, but they mean a lot to people. You get a new phone for Christmas and you've got your Okta client, that phone re-enrolled for your Okta client. Why would you need to do that manually? Just set it up and automate it. So we had a lot of little things and we had a lot of big things. And we ended up saving over 90,000 hours of sort of manual work. I will also say like those hours saved was back of the napkin. No one was getting the question. There was no, you know, retro, let's go audit and make sure you did that because the reality was it was around the mindset. So that's what automation domination is. I would love to answer any other more specific questions on that one for sure.
I think so. It sounds like it's a mix of process improvement, behavior change, actual automation tasks, maybe some AI. How did you go about identifying opportunities for efficiency gains? Like, was it top down, bottom up? Like, what did it look like? Like, what did it feel like on the journey?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I love so the answer is all of the above. It was a team sport, right? So I think you had some things like the standard deal process that was very much sort of top down, like, hey, we got to get better at this, right? So there was some executive support from our CFO, our chief revenue officer, like, hey, let's get this going. And so my team, again, back to what does a modern CIO do? My enterprise applications team was the one that's like, okay, let's get these things really moving. My job is to say, let's start digging in here. So that would be a top-down effect that really paid off in a big way. That was a big chunk of hours. I can't remember the exact number of hours, but it was a lot. But then we also had that bottoms up, and that was the automation champions group. So we had these mostly individual contributors that just felt passionate about it. And this is very simple stuff. Like, here's a spreadsheet. Nominate something you think we should work on. Get credit for it. Take a look at it. And some of them were as simple, you know, as I no longer have to worry about an approval process that I just used our existing tools that just automatically did it. There was a lot of activities there. So it really was a team sport. The top-down ones probably had the biggest impact because they were major process changes. Yeah. But we also didn't want to discount the small ones that really brought people into the fold and made their lives easier, you know?
That's just what I was going to ask you is, have you thought about the impact on the business? Because it's one thing to say, well, we saved all this time.
Yeah.
What do you do with the redeployed time? And then number one, and then number two, what's the impact been in the culture of the company? Like how have people reacted? Because sometimes that's the biggest part of this is you're taking away headaches.
I was nervous about like, hey, will people come to this? You know, you can provide the well. Are they going to drink from it? Right.
Yeah.
So in hindsight now, of course, you know, we've kicked off our automation domination 2.0 and it has gotten, people are so excited about it. You know, we use a Slack channel, people are chattering in there constantly and they want to be a part of it. So that's the, you know, the real sort of like everyone is going to do this and the buy-in there from a, so there's a lot to unpack there with your question,
yeah,
because there's also the business impact. Like, how do you truly measure that? So remember, it was to try to make it simple. It was really around hours saved, but we did get into more details around, and I just keep going back to the standard deal process because that's been such a big win. And you know, you have salespeople that are like, this has been a lifesaver. I was able to close a six-figure deal in 2 days through total automation and process improvement. There's a lot behind. There's like an automation and the signature gaining. There's an automation in the approval from a legal point of view. So it's a really, I'm making it sound simple, but it was a sophisticated, like there's many, many steps going here. And so what would take normally up to 2 weeks at best is now a 2-day experience. And then you've got someone, WinWire, talking about that incredible experience. And you only need a couple of those where people are like, I'm all in, let's do more of this. And so for this next year, we're going to be doing the same thing around renewals and customer success. So that was a new logo, new sale that I'm talking about from an automation win that will now turn into the renewal process. So yeah, it you only have to have a couple wins to really get everyone going. I see the light, let's get this going. And at the end of the day, if you're making their lives easier, that's the value right there. And then all the other goodness just comes because we're all humans and we want to do things as easy as possible.
Well, I like your example because it's a snowball effect, right? You made the salesperson's life easier. You increase their win rate because they can get the deal faster. You increase the money in their pocketbook. You increase employee retention. The whole thing just builds on top of itself.
Yeah.
I think sometimes that gets lost in these types of initiatives inside of companies or firms. It's like, you know, all the different sort of second and third order effects of just one process change, one systems change that can happen. So
Brian, I'm curious, as you were eliminating the waste and increasing efficiencies, was there an aha moment that came out of this that a new opportunity, whether it's for revenue growth or some other positive thing that you didn't anticipate show itself?
That's a good question. I will give you a couple thoughts here. One aha moment that I already innately knew, but back to sort of, you know, I'm helping my CIO brethren here, is you don't have to do it alone. Like a lot of this stuff can be just sort of crowdsourced and team. And like the aha moment was people were coming with ideas that even the IT organization, we call ourselves business technology, but the BT organization was not aware of. So there is the aha moment of like, let good people come up with creative ideas that you may not be thinking of. And so that was interesting. And so one of the individuals that, the individual that won the award at Sixth Sense at the end of the year, your company awards, here's our big OKRs, who demonstrated, I know, the biggest impact. Her name is Jules James, and she's a marketing operations director. And we provided tools, you know, iPaaS tools, Workato is what we use. And she sat down and wrote this very elaborate marketing automation thing that saved tons of hours of her time. And I never would have gotten to the details. Like my team couldn't have done that. She needed to do that. But it was about creating the environment, creating the space, the support structure. She had this really large sort of proof of concept she wanted to get done, and she did it in a sandbox. And then she partnered with us, and we brought that down to a much even more efficient process. And those are the sort of aha moments of like doing this together. The other thing I would say is get out of the way. Honestly, like let people do good work. I think a lot of times you want to control everything, and really your job should be more about enabling. And yes, you need to provide some guide rails. You know, you don't want people to go too crazy on certain things, and you got to pick the areas that are like, you know, if it's recognizing revenue, yes, that will have a lot of guardrails and tightness around it. But if it's other things, like get out of the way, let them be creative and do things. Those are a couple of the awesome outcomes that I don't know if I would call them. I guess I was hopeful, and those aha moments did happen. So it was great.
You know, it's funny, Brian, like every third or fourth podcast episode, Jeff says, get out of the way to me. I don't know exactly what he means.
Yeah, no, it's lead, follow, or get out of the way.
Oh, okay. All right, so we only have a little bit of time left with you, and I don't want to lose some time to talk a little more philosophically about AI in general, because we've talked on this arc so far. We've talked about how AI can impact your revenue model in terms of using a system like Sixth Sense. We've talked about some of the things you've done to drive efficiency, but I wanted to step back for a minute and just get your thoughts on my feeling and my read is that when you look at the market narrative on AI right now, it's all about efficiency and effectiveness, how AI is going to streamline so many things. But I think there's a time coming, hopefully soon, where that narrative changes and it becomes less about just driving cost out and more about creating growth. So I'd just like to get your thoughts philosophically as a CIO, kind of where you see AI right now and where you see it going. On those dimensions of sort of efficiency and you know, bottom line, top line kind of a thing.
Yeah. So right now, and this has nothing to do with Sixth Sense or the marketing tool stack or sales tool stack. This is just more philosophically, where are we at in today's world? So, you know, you almost can't even have a discussion with a group of tech individuals right now without talking about AI. It's like, it's impossible. It really is. It's like the top thing that everyone talks about constantly. My viewpoint here is with generative AI specifically, that's where all the sexiness is right now. Like, oh my goodness, I can write a simple query and I get back this just amazing human recognizable output. And that's great for sure. One of the things, though, that I'm not convinced of is, you know, that doesn't mean that you don't still do the same diligence around describing what the business outcome that you're looking for, what the business requirements are, and then really driving, especially on the generative AI viewpoint, driving to a business outcome. That hasn't changed, and you need to do that. I also think that a lot of it is just, it's productivity gains that are creating content for the most part. There's some exceptions here and there, but most of it's content creation, right? So you think of any of the copilots, that's around, can I write an email better? Can I search something faster? It's those sort of things. It's also around, are these point solutions, are those companies, or are they a feature that will be baked into a product at some point? And that's where we're at today. There are some exceptions and some pretty, large models that can help you do very specific things. You know, I think in the medical field, as an example, it'll be really interesting when you start getting some of these large language models to go solve for some medical, cancer, things that I'm outside of my realm to really talk in any great detail, but those are the things that are going to happen. But today, my viewpoint, it's around productivity gains, small bets, and thinking about how we can get some wins today, but then also thinking and staying on top of the future. I do think once we reach a level of super intelligence where these AI models can start to come up with solutions that we can't even think of, now that's going to be a whole nother tipping point in the world. That also brings on a lot of ethical questions. How do you put the right guardrails in place so that the outcomes are expected as opposed to unexpected outcomes? And the world in general will have to figure out how we're going to do that. So I do think that we're quickly approaching the beginnings of what that looks like. Some would argue that it's here now. So that's, and I could go really deep on this. I'll just say one last thing, and then I would love to get some other questions. But the other thing that's kind of interesting in today's world around the products we're seeing, it's very exciting. It can be, like, hey, look at all this amazing stuff, and we call it generative AI. But the reality is, it will all be software in the future. This will just be the expected behavior of the solutions you buy, and there'll be expected outcomes in your CRM, your ERP, your Salesforce as an example, or your whatever you're doing your financials with. Hopefully the audience knows all the acronyms, so you can add those if you like later. But it really is like you're just going to expect it, and so it will be software. When we start talking about some of the other large language models that are very specific around, curing medical diseases, those will be very specific, and that'll be an engine that someone or companies will use, research institutes, the big pharmas, stuff like this. But we're still a little ways away. And I know there's a lot of like job displacement fears. There's also going to be so many jobs created that we just can't even imagine right now. And we know this through history. It gets talked about all the time. I know that's just the very tip of sort of what you asked about there, but this is the way I think about it.
Yeah. We only have 5 minutes, and I have a question that just came to me that I want to ask you. So where do you think we are in the AI hype curve? And I want to relate it to your experience when you decided to go into, the CIO land basically in 1995, which I would argue was very early stages of the dot-com hype curve. Where do you think we are, having lived through that? And for our listeners who are too young to know this, 95 would have been the early stages. By 2000, 5 years in, you had dot-com bust, right?
Yeah.
So it was a 5-year window for this thing to explode, collapse, and then recover. What's your take?
my take is the hype is crazy right now. And you can see it, you know, if you wanted to use one example, you can look at the VC investment into AI companies, right? It's like, that's one area where the VC community is investing massively, right? There will be a lot of losers, like with any technology shift. There'll be some big winners, and there'll be a lot more losers. And the hype is real, but you've got to stay, as a tech executive, you need to stay calm and measured and really get back to, you know, is the hype worth the investment? I think that we're going to see bigger, more exciting real world solutions over the next 2 to 3 years that will be hard for us to imagine everything right now. I think it's very transformative. Like this, we're here to stay. We've crossed the chasm of what the world will look like using these AI products for sure, 100%. And it's exciting, but it's also like, it's a little daunting, I would say, for a lot of people to think about all this. And it's a little bit of like the unknown. So the hype is real. The unknown is real. But there's signals of like where this is all going. It's such a long, Jason, it's such a philosophical question that you could get. There could be a podcast, you know, series of podcasts, very specific on this one question. It's tough to encapsulate. And this is why we talk about it all the time, because it's changing. If you ask that question 6 months from now, the answer might change even. And that's how the rate of change is so extreme that it's hard to even speculate exactly where we're all going to be.
Yeah, that's why I love that analogy, that 5-year window to me of 95 to 2000. It was that roller coaster ride. It was such a crazy time.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Jeff.
We're going to have to introduce Brian to David DeWolf, and they can get a bottle of bourbon or something and sit around and talk about the philosophical dimensions of this.
Yeah.
100%.
Brian, one quick question that occurred to me, and this may be taken as backwards instead of forwards, but you mentioned, you know, the specificity of healthcare and a unique engine for that industry. Do you see AI beginning to get siloed into this industry specificity? And does that strengthen it, or does that limit it because it's not looking across industries at lessons to be learned from, you know, a different industry? I'm just curious your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I think what we're going to see is, and this is now we are speculating a little bit. This is where I think we're going.
Yeah.
I think you're going to have general large language models that is something that, you know, ChatGPT is all about, right? OpenAI products that are going to be just more generic. And then we really are going to see specific models that are designed to solve a certain thing. My thoughts here would be that the models that are specific to, and we just kind of went down the medical world, I think that there'll be sort of a group of models that will start working together to solve certain things. And those models will learn from each other. I think they'll just be general purpose models, like that is what everyone's excited about now, right? Where it's like, I need to craft an email. I need to create a job description, a knowledge base articles. And it happens like, it's like magic. Oh my goodness. It's like 90% there already. Or I'm, you know, crafting code. But I do think there's going to be this set of products or set of solutions that will be specific to an industry. It just makes sense because everyone wants to make sure that I'm not getting hallucinations in the output or drift, and it needs to be very tailored to a thing. So I do think that we're going to see that. And I think that's going to happen quickly. I think in the next 3 years, you will see products that are very industry specific. Shoot, for that matter, we're building that today. That is what we're doing. Our models will be very specific to creating signals and pipeline for marketers and salespeople. Like that we're literally building that today. So I do think that that's what's going to happen, Jeff. I think it's going to be very specific point solutions.
So the MarTech landscape will go from 8,000 products to 50,000 products over the next 3 years. And 46,000 of them will be created entirely by AI and only used by AI. Okay, moving on. So, Brian.
That was really pessimistic. Maybe AI will consolidate them and we'll just get down to 100.
That you could be right. You could be right. But I have a hunch our MarTech friend will agree with what I said. Okay, so Brian, if listeners want to find you, how do they find you?
You can find me on LinkedIn. Easy name, Bryan Wise. I got a Y in there. And please reach out to me. I would love to answer some questions in this area. It's fascinating. It's the most fascinating time to be a CIO. You can make more impact and be more of a thought leader now than ever. And it's a fun time for sure.
Well, thank you so much for joining us. You raised the bar high for future CIO guests. So it's always good to start at the top, work your way up, make it harder on everybody. So thank you so much.
Jason and Jeff, thank you. It was a pleasure. Really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to Rattle and Pedal, divergent thoughts on marketing and growing professional services firms. Find content related to this episode at rattleandpedal.com. Rattle and Pedal is also available on iTunes and Stitcher.